Dark Culture.
Hi, my name is Poe Johnson, and I'm here with Narratives in Dark Culture. I'm here today with Dr. Lisa Yazyk. Dr. Yazyk is a professor and associate chair of the School of Literature, Media, and Communication at Georgia Tech. Amongst other things, her research re-examines the contributions of women and people of color in the history of science fiction, as evidenced in her latest book, Sisters of Tomorrow, The First Women of Science Fiction. Thank you, Dr. Yazyk, for joining us today.
Thanks so much for having me. I appreciate it.
All right, so I'm going to start with one question, and it's going to sound a little strange, but sort of roll with me on it. What's it like to be you?
Ha! What's it like to be me? Most days, I'd say it's pretty great. You know, I'm probably one of about a dozen people who actually gets to call themselves a professor of science fiction studies. You know, most of us have to, who are interested in science fiction, have to pass as being really interested in something else, like mainstream literature or some kind of art. So, and then get to teach maybe a few science fiction classes on the side. But you know, I'm at an institute that's been committed to the serious study of science fiction for well over 40 years now, and we really have a lot of space for professors to explore speculative narrative across media, and it's exciting. So that's part of it, yeah.
So, and then we're going to touch back upon this idea of, like, you being one of the only 12 people who get to actually call yourself professor of science fiction, or however you want to word that. But first, let's sort of, like, correct me if I'm wrong, so we can understand, like, so we can lay for the audience as a groundwork. One way, when I've read your work, is to think of your work as, in your research, as you're someone who sort of studies subaltern cultural history of science fiction. Could you describe your research more thoroughly than that? And how do you find yourself engaging in this kind of work?
Yeah, sure. I really see myself as thinking about science fiction as a global literature, let's say, that crosses centuries and continents and cultures, but it's a shared narrative form that allows people from very different places and times to effectively and often very eloquently express their ideas about science and technology and society to one another. So when you talk about it that way, it sort of gives me a very wide playing field, but what I'm particularly interested in is looking at, as you had said, subaltern voices, or at least the people we don't usually associate with science fiction. So, for instance, historically we've talked about science fiction as being about boys and their toys, but of course the genre, one of the founding parents of the genre is Mary Shelley, and as a lot of my research has shown, women have always had rather strong and important investments in science fiction and have made important contributions. I've also been interested in debunking the idea that science fiction is for white boys and their toys, but that, again, it really allows people from all walks of life to grapple with issues of science and technology and race, and to imagine futures that aren't necessarily whitewashed, but that could be in full color.
All right, so, and there's a couple of different things I want to touch upon what you just said, but let's start with the concepts of sort of gender, because you mentioned Mary Shelley and how she's one of these leading figures in science fiction, which kind of leads into your most recent book, which is Sisters of Tomorrow. So could you tell me a little bit about that particular project, how it came about, what it's trying to accomplish?
Yeah, so I had been doing work for about a decade on the role of women in science fiction, and in particular, I was interested in the kinds of work that women did in the science fiction community and that they continue to do in the science fiction community in between periods of heightened feminist activity. We have a tendency to assume that women came into science fiction in the 1960s and 70s with the revival of feminism, and that that was really the first time that they made their mark in science fiction. And while it certainly is true that a whole new group of women who were very distinctly thinking about feminist science fiction came into the community at that time, there have obviously been women writing. What I found in my research is that women have always written science fiction in about the same numbers, or at least in the same percentages, whether or not they're working in periods that we associate with feminist activity. So I've been asking myself, well, what are the other kinds of things that women have been writing about? Like, if women aren't coming to science fiction purely as a political vehicle, what are the other things that attract them? Are there aesthetics? Are there other modes of politics? Is it the opportunity to explore culture? What is it? And what I found is that it was a lot of all of those things. So I had done a book in 2008 called Galactic Suburbia, Recovering Women's Science Fiction. And that book looked specifically at the generation of women right before the advent of feminist science fiction. So I was looking at women science fiction writers of the 40s and 50s. And while I was doing that, my editor had said, you know, this is such a cool book, and the stories you talk about seem really neat, but those stories aren't accessible to anyone unless you're at a university that happens to have a science fiction collection and you can dig into the old pulp magazines. And she said, you know, I think it would be really great if after this book you brought out an edited anthology of those stories so people would have access to them again. And unfortunately, she was at that point at a press that didn't do that kind of work. But there are presses, of course, that do. And so I got to thinking, I thought, this is a really exciting idea to bring out some of these old stories. And then I thought, why not take it all the way back to the 1920s, which a lot of people see as the beginning of science fiction as a distinct and unique popular genre, and look at what women were doing then as well. And that's what got us to Sisters of Tomorrow.
And so what's interesting to me about that is you mentioned this kinds of that women have been working on science fiction essentially since as long as there has been science fiction. And then there is this more recent occurrence within the 20s and 30s, sort of starting with Herbo Grimm's back, Amazing Stories and Weird Tales and things like that, or maybe I had that switched. So can you speak to like the sort of the element of feminism in those stories themselves? Do the women themselves think of themselves as feminists, or was this more of a later idea?
It's an interesting question. And I think the answer is complicated, that we know from the historical record that a number of the women who were involved in the pulp magazine community of the 20s and 30s and 40s did indeed participate in the universal suffrage movement or had links to other kinds of feminism or other kinds of progressive politics. For instance, a number of women did work in the African-American civil rights movement and in the indigenous American civil rights movement. So women, like men, were coming with certain kinds of political investments and beliefs, and they did sometimes work those ideas into their stories. And there's some funny examples that we get to talk about in the book, as well as really great anecdotes that the authors themselves remembered and have passed on. But I don't think that for any of them that was their primary purpose in coming to science fiction. Women, like men, of that period were really in science fiction because they were excited about the possibilities of science and technology. And while they might not have access to scientific or technological careers, this became a way to participate in talking about science and technology on a very public platform. And so I think that that was really important to many women, just as it was to men. And then I really think the most important thing for everyone in the early science fiction community was simply building the genre. So these may be people who had certain political or scientific investments, but they also recognized that they were all in this together and that if they couldn't figure out how to sell science fiction as a coherent genre, no one was going to be able to play in that field anymore. So really, I think a lot of the early efforts simply go into building the genre.
Okay, that's interesting. So, and it's also interesting how you linked it to sort of how or those early women were also engaged in these other social justice movements, which kind of leads me into Afrofuturism. I mean, you're considered one of the more leading scholars of Afrofuturism. So how do you define it? Because it seems to me that Afrofuturism has this kind of contested definition depending on who you ask and certainly depending on when you ask them. So how do you personally define it?
Yeah, it is. It is. It's a tricky question. And I'm actually working on an edited anthology right now of Afrofuturism. And that's really a question that I notice many of our contributors are grappling with. And in fact, we're thinking about having a whole section now called What Comes After Afrofuturism, because it's a term. And like so many terms in the science fiction community and the larger literary community, it has a certain use in terms of marketing and community building. But it's also a historically bound and a sort of fraught term. So my understanding of Afrofuturism, personally, at this point in time, as I've been sort of working through this, is I see it as a mode of, I want to say art, although it can also include scholarship and criticism, but a mode of aesthetic production that combines elements of Western speculative fiction, certainly science fiction, but also fantasy and horror, with non-Western and indigenous mythologies, occult practices, beliefs and ideas. And so I see the two as coming together in Afrofuturism. And interestingly, I used to have a different feeling about who could write Afrofuturism too.
Okay.
Originally, the way that Mark Derry, the critic from the Village Voice, who originally coined the term, or at least popularized the term, he talked about this as a mode of aesthetic production, a lot like what I'm saying here, although he was much more interested in the remix of science and technology than he is in remixing non-Western narrative practices. But he also really thought about it as a post-war and maybe even U.S.-American phenomena, mm-hmm. and that it was really a mode of literature or aesthetic expression that where people would use these different narrative practices to remix our ideas about the past and the present and our possible futures. I still think that much of it is true. I do think it's a hybrid narrative practice. I think it's a lot like science fiction in that way, and that it's about mixing traditions together to speak new realities. But I no longer am convinced that we can have such clear-cut geographical boundaries or temporal boundaries. I know a number of people who've been doing work, including myself, that pushes the boundaries of Afrofuturism back. And you can even go back and look at, for instance, Phyllis Wheatley's poetry as being a poetry of alien abduction. And so I think once you start thinking about it that way, you can really see that kind of speculative practice goes, logically enough, way before World War II. I think it becomes more visible at World War II for a number of production and distribution reasons. But I also think that at this point, I'm hesitant to say Afrofuturism stops just at the borders of the United States. Lots of people would say, of course not. It's the whole Black Atlantic, you know, both sides of the ocean, and I agree with that. But I'm beginning to think that we might be able to productively think about Afrofuturism, or whatever term we want to use, as encompassing some of the speculative practices that we see coming out of authors and film directors and editors from across the African continent as well. So for me, I really want to see it as a global practice. I want it to be a big tent like science fiction, and I want everyone to be able to play in it, or at least a lot of people.
And that's interesting too, this kind of notion of inclusion. So because, I mean, one of the more interesting questions asked is, how did you become involved in sort of studying Afrofuturism to begin with? Like, what was, I don't mean it in an accusatory way, I just mean, like, how did this sort of practice, how did you start engaging in this practice itself, and where did your own interest come from?
Yeah, you know, it's funny because I often try to remember this myself, and I at this point I don't remember ever not being interested in Afrofuturism, but surely there must have been a time I wasn't. But, you know, I grew up in and around Detroit, and then I lived through the era of techno, so I was always sort of hearing the, you know, speculative practices of DJs and people and outfits like Drexia, you know, DJs like Derek May. But I think that more importantly, I got really interested in Afrofuturism probably in the late 1990s, before I really had much of a grasp of it, through my work at WISCON, which is the oldest and largest feminist science fiction convention in I believe, the world. And I had met a young Nalo Hopkinson and some other authors of color who were talking about how you do science fiction when you're both are and are not part of the West, and how you mix these different traditions together. And I was so taken by her description of trying to write science fiction in like a Creole language, and finding that it was just easier to write in English because so many techno-scientific words are English. And I just thought, that is really interesting. And about that same time, I was starting to do work on Ralph Ellison, and I was thinking about him as an American author who engages issues of science and technology. And I've just never been able to make peace with the end of Invisible Man. Mm-hmm. And, you know, the more I grappled with it and the more I started reading in Afrofuturism, it suddenly occurred to me that this was where I wanted to be thinking about things. Like, when Ellison writes, I didn't set out to write a piece of science fiction. You look at Invisible Man and say, and yet it's sort of what you ended up doing. But it's not quite science fiction as usual. But I do think it was Afrofuturism. And once I started to think about, well, how can you be an Afrofuturist and not even know it, perhaps, it just got really exciting. And I got excited thinking about Ellison as an Afrofuturist, and then I started to do work on contemporary Afrofuturist artists and people who really claim that title. And it just sort of snowballed for from there. And I think what I liked, broadly speaking, about Afrofuturist art as I encountered it is that since the 1980s, at least, science fiction and much of the popular imagination has really been just gripped by dystopia and obsessed with dystopia and the idea that we're at the end of times. And yet, clearly we're not at the end of times. And for many people, things continue to get better. So I wanted to think about, and I got so excited about Afrofuturism as a kind of science fiction that was trying to think past these dystopian moments and to imagine really different futures. And it's a real turn-on for me as a science fiction scholar, you know, and I could see those new futures opening up, and that's why I got excited about it.
And so it's interesting to me, again, as I mentioned before, how this is kind of like a cultural history or a subaltern cultural history of science fiction that you're engaging in. Is that how do you think that these issues sort of relate to one another? This concept, on one hand, of you're dealing with early women in the 1920s and 30s, and then obviously later, who started sort of breaking into the science fiction field, and then you're dealing, on the other hand, with Afrofuturism, which is like this African and diasporic notion of how to sort of look at the past as a way to examine the future. And how do you think these two things are related, if at all?
Well, I think they are both related in that these are both groups of authors who have a certain vested political interest in staking claims for themselves and their people, which I'd put in quote marks, but for certain groups in the future imaginary, we tend to imagine futures often that look a lot like the present, what Joanna Russ called galactic suburbia. Mm-hmm. That, you know, even when you're in a far-off future, you know, or a place long, long ago in a galaxy far, far away, it looks all too much like next door. And I think that what you see are, in these subaltern traditions, are groups of people who have always had really intense and interesting ties to scientific and technological development, sticking a claim for themselves and remembering those histories and showing how they can indeed be part of the future. And the fact that you see women coming into science fiction in the 1920s, and you do see a lot of African-Americans writing science fiction, not in the pulp magazines necessarily, but in African-American magazines. There's an excitement about that and a belief that we can build different futures at that point. And so I think it's no surprise that we start to see women and African-Americans, well, that everyone's always been writing science fiction, but that it's really starting to get some public notice in the magazines at the early 20th century.
So, and in terms of, because you are, again, one of the sort of the only 12 people to sort of really do this in terms of science fiction studies.
Well, at least, allowed themselves that, yeah, exactly. There's hundreds of us doing it. I want all my people to do
that. Well, just recognized as doing it, right? So, have you received a lot of pushback from within the academy for this work, or do you find yourself sort of finding these correct no's in which you can do the work, kind of work that you want to?
I have been fortunate in both my institutional and organizational affiliations that I don't receive pushback at Georgia Tech at all. If anything, I get quite the opposite. I have faculty come up to me from College of Engineering, College of Sciences, College of Design, and they say, oh, you're one of the science fiction professors. I totally get what you do. And then usually it either follows with, like, you know, a long explanation of science fiction they like or some science fiction they're actually working on, which is really cool. But then they say, you know, what I don't get are those Shakespeare professors in your department. What are they doing here at a technical institute? So I find it interesting that at a technical institute, you know, a place that builds engineers, they're very excited about science fiction, which of course used to be called the literature of engineers. And in fact, my students and I were just talking about that today, how the heroes of the early stories are all exactly what Georgia Tech wants them to be when they grow up. So I find that working at a technical institute, yeah, I've had a lot of support. And because when you're at a technical institute, it sort of changes your career path. If you're a literature scholar, you're already seen as doing something weird by being there instead of at a liberal arts institute. You know, the fact that you're doing science fiction just sort of, it's all logical and it's all of a piece. So I've been fortunate that I haven't had that kind of pushback at all. Now, what I find, if anything, is I'm probably the annoying, pushy one that when I read or review essays or books by people who aren't familiar with the field, I'm like, oh, no, you're not familiar with the field. So, yeah, I've been really fortunate in that respect. Also, I think it's important that the science fiction community has a lot of very strong professional organizations that are very dedicated to supporting the and nurturing young scholars, and then helping advanced scholars really maximize their career potential. So the Science Fiction Research Association, About Science Fiction at University of Kansas, these are all amazing organizations that have done a lot. They provide awards, they provide administrative experience, they provide research support. So I feel very fortunate, and again, I know this is unusual, that I've been supported in this career, and I haven't received any pushback at all. Of course, I've chosen to sort of stay out of the mainstream literary magazines, to forfeit my MLA subscription, so I'm a little bit of an apostate literature scholar already, it's worked out fine, and I haven't felt that push. I've been lucky.
Which actually leads me to my final question, but it's also kind of the one that this project that I'm working on here, this podcast that you're on right now, is sort of really trying to wrestle with. And because one of the goals is to sort of openly acknowledge that our various subject positions have impact on how we perceive the world, right? And it certainly has impact on our access. So considering your own subject position, which I will let you define if you so choose, rather than me do that, how do you think that your experience has, and I mean that in terms of subject positions, has influenced your work? And I mean that kind of like from an intersectional perspective, right? So you have like a racial identity and you have a gender identity, and these things sort of have marry in some aspects and perhaps conflict in other ones. So how do these things work for you?
I do feel that a lot of my research is motivated by personal experience, and exactly what you're talking about, the experience of having grown up white and female in Detroit, and then living in Atlanta, right? So two very successful black cities and often defined as masculine black cities, although I'm not sure that's really correct. I grew up thinking about race and about different kinds of futures, and it matters, and it matters whether you're white or black. And I feel like sometimes this is one of the tricks of Afrofuturism is I don't want it to become so thoroughly defined that we can't allow people of different races to explore. I don't want it to become simple identity politics, the way that feminism has historically sometimes become simple identity politics. Well, if you're not a woman, you don't have that experience, you can't participate in the discussion. So I hope that that's not the case. I mean, certainly my own experience is not going to be the same as those of my, you know, African-American or Indigenous American colleagues. But I do feel that having grown up in cities and now living in a city where we think about race a lot is important, and it feels meaningful to me. In terms of gender, that in some ways is almost trickier to talk about, and I'm not sure why that is exactly. I've never felt out of place as a woman in the science fiction community. I can certainly say that. But I'm from a family of engineers, and I like heavy metal music, and a lot of things are sort of guy-identified, so maybe that doesn't make a difference. But I do feel that as a woman who's raised by parents who were feminists, science fiction has been important because it allows you to think about these new futures, and it allows you to talk about them and express them in some very practical ways that, when I do other kinds of political activism, it's not necessarily as satisfying or as meaningful. I feel like I can get more people to think about what race and gender and sexual orientation mean by reading a short story about a lesbian AI than I ever would by lecturing on like the subject of sexuality or, you know, nature versus nurture. So I do think that having grown up thinking about these issues certainly influenced my decision to do this kind of research. So that's what I've got for you.
No, it was fantastic. I would ask one last question then as a kind of follow-up, relating back to the Afrofuturism question, that is there perhaps then, because Afrofuturism is still this nascent idea, at least in terms of like an intellectual method of inquiry, that who gets to define it sort of still matters, right? Because there's like issues of colonialism that are already embedded within it that what occurs if sort of it becomes too open, right? And because we can't always trust institutions to do the right thing, or we rarely can trust institutions to do the right thing, is there a danger that sort of it gets sort of ripped out of its context?
Well, I think that context is evolving. So I actually hope it's getting ripped out of its context.
Fair enough.
So I think that that's actually really important and part of the dialogue. So what's interesting is we talk about Afrofuturism as being a pretty nascent, if not aesthetic practice, at least an idea or a way of talking about a kind of aesthetic practice. But the reality is Mark Derry coined that term back in the early 1990s. Mm-hmm. And so at this point, it's what, 20, 30 years old. And in the science fiction community, most science fiction movements last about 20 or 30 years before they evolve into something else. So I think it's no surprise that all of a sudden we see people asking exactly this question about Afrofuturism. And I think that's what I find more interesting is, why are we all asking this question right now? Because for 20, 30 years, we were all happy to say, hey, Mark Derry had this really great idea and defined this in this really neat way. And now, right, there are sort of questions about, well, how do we feel about Mark Derry as a white man having defined a diasporic or even a black aesthetic movement? Are those terms that still make sense? Where is the Afro in Afrofuturism? Does it have to be future-oriented? All of these questions are really great questions. I recently did a panel with Bill Campbell and some other authors at the State of Black Science Fiction Conference, and we were having this conversation, and I thought it was very interesting that I saw a real generational divide, that younger people, both black and white, are anxious for a new term beyond Afrofuturism. Mm-hmm. And I've seen this when I've traveled, when I was in Europe as well this last summer. I talked to lots and lots of grad students very interested in this phenomena, but who don't like the term. But, you know, as the older authors and editors there, I thought were a little more, I don't want to say accepting, but a little more flexible about and less passionate about the need to turn over the terminology. And I love what Bill Campbell said. He said, you know, I don't know if I'm an Afrofuturist or not, but people have been telling me this since day one, and I've claimed the tag because it provides me with a marketing tool and a way to send a very quick and specific message to readers about what it is I do. And he said, I also like it because it's such a great hashtag on Twitter, and it's such a great way of building community, and you reach more young people through this sexy and sort of inscrutable term than you would through black speculative fiction or something like that that's a little more prosaic. So I think his point was that it's this pretty sexy term, and it seems to work for the moment, and as soon as someone comes up with something better, he's all over it. And I like that attitude. I think the idea of letting people fight it out, I think that's important because that's the way we don't let institutions or maybe even single individuals grab a term away. I think keeping that debate open and saying, well, what comes next is important.
Well, thank you very much. That was actually all that I have for you. That was wonderful. I want to thank you again, Dr. Yazyk, for joining us today. This is Poe Johnson signing off for Narratives in Dark Culture. Have a great day.
Thank you.
Dark Culture.